goes to community projects, schools, clinics, all these kinds of things, often that thank my doctors and thank my teachers. There's all sorts of finicky standards. I know one tea factory that was rejected for fair trade status because the drinking water tap wasn't labelled as drinking water, even though everybody in the factory knew where the drinking water came from. And it seems that there is a deep-seated resentment that there is a lot of value now increasingly being created here in the UK and Europe from fair trade brands. Sainsbury's makes, you know, carved out a real niche for themselves. Others have done the same. That's where the value is. Some of it gets passed down. There is a premium price, but it doesn't actually reach the pockets of farmers. That's the conservative.
So what would be, what do you think needs to change? If we're sitting here, what can we do to help those farms? Is there anything we can do at all, or is that just the way it is? Leaving aid out
of the I think, you know, there needs to be fairness in the market, and as a consumer, I think, you know, fair trade is better, probably better than other things. My managing director in Kenya was used to be in charge of selling Kenyan tea around the world, and he would like to scrap fair trade completely from the Kenyan tea producers and exporters perspective. And I was surprised at that, I really was.
Maybe I can make some comments more generally on certification schemes. Especially now in tea and coffee and cocoa, which are three of the main products exported from Africa to the UK, there's some very interesting stuff going on. All three of those products are, you know, fetching quite high prices at the moment, generally. And Africa is in a relatively good position for once in terms of getting some decent prices. It's interesting that the companies that use these products are actually, I think, quite concerned about sustainable supply. And they want to make sure that they can go on getting these products. And that has changed their whole approach, if you like, to how they secure them. So whereas tea used to be sold at the mass auction mostly, still is mostly, and cocoa was a commodity, traded on futures markets as a commodity with different grades. All these companies are now looking to develop supplies directly with producers. And I would argue that that's not a bad thing for the producers, because they can get into a long-term relationship with an end buyer who will pay at least world market prices. Now, in terms of fair trade, Rainforest Alliance, quota certification, these schemes have been picked up by a lot of these companies as a good way to build these relationships with small farmers and also to help with sustainable supply. So Rainforest Alliance, for example, which you probably know, is a mixture of social standards and environmental standards, working together with the tea industry and the buyers and the farmers can come up with standards for growing tea that are sustainable and deliver certain social standards. I'm not saying that, you know, the reason that the tea companies have gone for these things is entirely altruistic, but they've picked up on the usefulness of these certification schemes to enable them to secure long-term supplies, but in return, I think, you know, they also see they can use that as a responsible business model, and they can market the tea as showing they're responsible corporate citizens. And I'm not sure it's a bad thing. Fair trade has its own particular issues, which you know, they vary from product to product. But certainly, it's true that the supermarkets you know, have no problem at all making their margin on model. You guys, the consumers out there, you want choice. You need supermarkets, you want to be able to choose, you know, what kind of product you buy. Fair trade is another option for you. Rainforest is another option. And it's a competitive area.
I've been convinced I'm not the household name even in my own household, so but I'm very, very worried from what I heard. If it supporting Expo, because that is a very, very dangerous group. In the last few months, we've seen, for example, there's been a decrease in consumption of tobacco worldwide, or at least in Europe. 14% of exports of Malawi have been lost that way. 4 or 5 weeks ago, there was a in Newsnight, slavery in the cocoa plantations in Ivory Coast, which we all thought had disappeared. No, we mustn't buy green beans and flowers from East Africa. And it's very simple, because when something goes wrong, like the volcanic eruption in the, whatever it was in Iceland 18 months ago, maybe that $250 million worth of flowers per day were lost to Kenya, Ethiopia, and Uganda. What we need is to do something that in sunny Brixton, where I live, has been introduced for the last couple of years, which is the Brixton Pound. Vouchers given to local people to buy locally. If we want to increase the productivity and the marketability of the small farmer, we need to give to people who are starving vouchers to buy food locally, not donating it unless there are emergencies, certainly not exporting. I can say more on that stuff.
Then that's just to boost the local economy.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, all right, that's one question. Yeah,
another
question. Yeah.
Just three quick comments on the story. I want you to carry my comment on what was the story in the context of the various points you made. Secondly, could the panel comment on the possible role of partnership between the big land investors, which, you know, they're in Tanzania and every other place? Have they a role to play? Should the governments force them to play a role in relation to smallholders? And thirdly, infrastructure. Let me just give you one very small example from Tanzania earlier this year. In the western part of Tanzania, where there is quite a large production of rice and other cereals, the failure from the farming point of view was the inability of the railway to get to Banda to pick up the crops and take them to Dar es Salaam. So there are a number of issues like this which directly relate not to agriculture but to other aspects of government activities which one needs to take into account.
Okay. There's a third question. Yeah,
David Campbell. I'm come from the Fellowship Trust.
Rwanda have been a lot of people killed and reliably on drowning
and then finally find its way into the market. The project that we're supporting is with Sainsbury's and an NGO to go into that area where there is nothing working. There's no public sector services there. There's barely a school, there's no healthcare, the roads are all gone, no power. I'm working with farmers' cooperatives there to get that quality, get that coffee up to quality, and get it out and get it onto the shelves of Sainsbury's, where it came out as a nose product with a good publicity. Now, the difference in price that we're able to give those farmers for that coffee compared to what they were getting before is there's no comparison. And I can tell you, I went to the local school there, and the teacher, although he's speaking French, so a kind of French that he's forgiving, but we managed somehow. But he just pointed around all the children in the class who were there because that coffee was playing their feet. So I don't think we should make too many generalizations about what market is good, what market is not good. Yes, things happen like the volcano. If people, most of the big flour exporters who were losing all that money, these are mostly big companies. I don't know if they had insurance or if they didn't, but they're still in business. So. The issue of vouchers, when you have, you know, when you have a famine or you have a crop failure in a cereal crop growing area, and we have it, you know, we all know it happens fairly often. As Amartya Sen said, the problem is that, not that there's no food available, the problem is people don't have money to buy the food that's available because, you know, their crop has failed. Whether you give them vouchers to buy locally or you give them cash to buy locally, and there's a lot of cash transfer programs now. I mean, that's, I agree, I mean, it's much better to do that than start bringing in, you know, food aid from the US with it. I could go on with those, but maybe that's someone else answer the other questions.
But I know you probably say, well, you wouldn't start from here, but if you were starting from scratch, is it, what do you think is better? Smallholder growing their own food enough for them and creating a surplus and selling that? Or is it going off to work for a day wage on a great big farm owned by a foreigner? I mean, which do you think is better?
They, you know, they're both going to be better. You know, I can tell you, if you look at wage rates paid for farm workers, you will always find that the wages paid by the rich guy in the village will be lower than the wages paid on the big farm, almost in every case. If you look at the wages paid in tea, for example, if you go to Kenya and you look at the big tea estates and what they pay for plucking tea, they will pay more than the small-scale farmers will pay for plucking tea. If you've got the resources...
Do you know what things are in dollars, by the way?
Not in dollars, it's quite a big difference. You know, it's a substantial difference.
Well, we'll look into that, won't we?
So if you're, you know, if you're a very... I can give you an example. I remember staying in a village in Tanzania and trying to understand the dynamics in the village. And there was this woman who, she was trying to plant five pieces of land, because the land was very fragmented. She was planting five pieces of land all over the place, with a long walk between each one, because that was the land that she had access to. So she was very ambitious at the beginning of the season. She thought she could manage to plant all of these five plots, and if she planted them all and looked after them all, she would get a good harvest and she'd have enough food. Trouble was that during the course of the season, she was short of cash, so she went to work for other people. And by having to work for other people, she neglected her own fields, so they got full of weeds, and some of them she actually abandoned. So when it comes to the harvest, she's only harvesting, whatever, three of those plots, and she's getting a very low yield. To me, if she had employment, a decent job, with a fresh for her kids, better off. But there's another person in that village who's in a different stage. Maybe they've got two kids, 18 and 19 years old. The four of them can work together. You know, it's not simple. It's much more complicated. And even as you go through your life,
land deals and bad land deals. I've seen some really bad ones in Ethiopia where the government has sold land under the feet of local people without their knowledge at all. But then again, you look at, say, a land deal I know about where there's a big investment by an Indian company in sugar production in the Afar Valley in Ethiopia. A land inhabited by pastoralists, relatively low productivity by most terms. Somebody's going to divert the Awash River and create the biggest sugar farm in Africa, allegedly. That sugar factory will produce sugar, some domestic market, most of it will be exported, probably back to India, I guess. It will also generate probably 100 times more livestock feed than was being produced on the natural rangeland there. But we know that the Afar people are not going to be employed on that farm. They're not going to have anything to do with that farm. And the chances of there being any intelligent linkage between the two to be mutually supportive is very, very low. And that's, it's a difficult one because there's some pros and cons in that example. For the Afar themselves, the land was sold from right under their feet, or at least from under their feet, to this company. Look at some other land deals in Zambia and so on, where there'd be legal land acquisitions and a lot of investment gone in and some good relationship built with smallholder farmers who can be both labourers on a large farm and smallholder farmers. And I think what you're seeing a lot is an ageing farming population and a farming population in Africa that's becoming increasingly sort of part-time, essentially, with a lot more off-farm employment. Coming into play, various kinds of employment on large farms could be one of those sources of additional income. So I think it can be good. A lot of it has been really bad, and I wouldn't want to put off genuinely proper investors from investing in building infrastructure and developing skills, as they've talked about in Africa, because of these bad, this whirlwind of bad PR. But equally, there have been some really rubbish deals around as well where local people have been really badly treated.
Okay. Thank you. Let's take some more questions.
I'm not sure if it's a question or more point I'd like to make, but I'm surprised that the omission of the panel to mention subsidies and how you mentioned markets as a conveyor signal into information, whereas in Europe, especially France, is clear and equal in the balance how Europe carrying on the subsidies and on the other hand is preaching Africa to free markets. I'd like to know if you have your opinion, what would it be?
Subsidies. Could you just tell us who you are?
Post-graduate development economics. Jobless at the moment. Anyone who wants my CV, please. Infrastructure and market developed as an alternative or an additional market opportunity for smallholders could be part of the solution, but thoughts from the panel?
Richard Ferguson, Head of Agriculture at Renaissance Capital, Emerging Markets Bank, with a big presence in Africa. Can I just point out, maybe sort of dealing with that sort of what I call practicality, in terms of, you know, this debate over smallholders and large-scale farms. I spent 9 years in China, and one of the things is that, you know, 10 years ago the average Chinese was eating something like 42, 43 kilograms of meat a year. Now, if we take it from where we've gone in the last 10 years, where we're going to go in the next 10, 15 years, you're basically looking at a situation where China is going to have to require something like 90 to 100 million tonnes of cereals from various parts of the world. Now, that's not going to come from relying ever more on the Americas, especially Brazil and Argentina. And meanwhile, you've got massive bottlenecks in the CIS, you know, through the Black Sea ports, which is not something that's going to be answered very quickly. That means that China has to rely on opening up Africa. And what I would say is we can deal with ideals about what is the best way forward. I don't think there is a kind of a right and a wrong. I think it is, we keep saying it's a very, very complicated issue. But more than anything, they are going to come because they need to. The development of the Brazilian cerrados over the past 40 years was basically driven over the past 15 years by Chinese demand. That is something that's going to have to now come from Africa if the Chinese don't want to rely on too narrow a focus of several key nations.
FID, we
think certainly there are some commodities where subsidies are really distorted markets. We know